Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and tonight Bob KD2NVB will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as to promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website, and the link can be found on the front page in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to directly go to it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob KD2NVB will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
KD2NVB here. Good evening, Roy. Good evening to everybody on the net. This is Bob, KD2NVB. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. So this is another episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, where you have an opportunity to either bring up a topic, tell us about something that you've discovered, or ask a technical question. So if any of those things apply to you out there, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign, and whether you have a comment or a question tonight. Okay, well, we'll give it a try again. I realize it's only 9:03. Some people forget which is the second and fourth Wednesday of the month, and it's whether it's 9 o'clock or it's 9:10 or what's going on. Other people, you know, have lives and such, so I understand why some of the people who tend to participate kind of come in a little bit later. I wish I had some interesting topic to discuss tonight. I hadn't really thought about it. We do have a puzzle, as I mentioned before, and hopefully people will take a look at it. It's a relatively simple puzzle, if you know what you're talking about, and doesn't really require any illustrations. The question for those listening out there is, if an AM signal is 100% modulated with a sine wave audio tone, the amplitude of each of the sidebands is... And then you get four choices. A is half of that of the carrier. B is equal to that of the carrier. C is twice that of the carrier. And D is four times that of a carrier. And if you're unaware what an amplitude modulation signal really looks like, we all know AM from broadcast bands. We had AM radios growing up, and we still do. It's modulating a steady frequency carrier by a changing audio frequency. It modulates the amplitude of the RF carrier. So what you end up doing is generating what's called sidebands. If you take a look at a spectrum scope, when an amplitude modulated signal is reaching you, is you get in the middle the carrier frequency, that's the constant frequency, and then you get the sidebands on either side, which is a combination over time of a bunch of audio frequency offsets. Either the audio frequency adds to the carrier on one side and subtracts from the carrier on the other side. And those two sidebands are what makes single sideband. If you get rid of the carrier and you get rid of one of the sidebands, you're left with a single sideband transmission. So once again, we will save that until hopefully a little later use it as a puzzle. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any technical questions, topics, or comments for the Technical Net, please give me your name and your call sign.
AC2GS. For you, Glenn in Bay Ridge.
Is that you, Glenn? I couldn't hear your call sign. I heard mine.
Sorry, Roy. N4ESU, Glenn in Bay Ridge.
Okay, very good, Glenn. I recognize the voice. Do you have a question or a comment tonight?
Just checking in to support the net, listen and learn, no particular question, and to congratulate Bob on his new role as your sidekick.
Well, thank you very much, Glenn. I look forward to Bob in this new position, and hopefully we'll get some questions tonight. Once again, this is AC2GS, and if you have any questions of a technical nature or topics you would like to roll around and discuss, or, you know, something that was discussed previous technical nets that you went back and tinkered with and discovered something, that's a good reason, too. So anyone out there who has anything to contribute, please give me your call sign and your first name.
82NVP, I got something if nobody else is going to come in right now.
I think this would be a good opportunity, Bob.
KD2NVP. It's not a great question. I might bring in something better, but it's, you know, I kind of know the answer, but you probably give a more detailed, in-depth thing. I've just noticed listening to a lot of, this is just broadcast FM I'm talking about at the moment, but it's the same thing, it's radio. And of course, these are much stronger signals. And yet, you know, I've just noticed that certain stations I listen to all the time with the using this radio with the Magma usually gets better reception than I have a clock radio in my room. It's just one of those, I guess they're crude dipoles, you know, those antennas they give you, that's just a T-shaped wire that you hook up. Anyway, something that always got great reception has lately been, you know, really inconsistent. I have to move it around. I'm talking about strong broadcast stations, so I guess it means like something in the neighborhood might have changed or God knows what, but I don't know if you can flesh that out anymore, if it's just kind of a not the greatest question. But I am curious about it. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. I mean, if you're talking about frequency modulation, FM band, AM bands, as we all know and love, usually use a small magnetic coil in the body of the AM radio. It's not terribly efficient, but the AM radios around us put out so many watts that it suffices. In the case of FM, which is a higher frequency, you usually get those little pieces of open wire line with a split and a T, and the idea is to stick the two legs of the T as far away, and as you mentioned, it's basically just a poor man's dipole cut for the FM band. Assuming that nothing is going wonky with the front end of your radio's receiver sensitivity, and nothing is going wonky with the connection of the antenna wire and such, it is possible that as time goes on, different things in the environment can block ground wave propagation, because FM is basically a ground wave propagation phenomena. So if there's a building that's put up, if there's a water tower that's moved around, a lot of different environmental things can affect the propagation of FM broadcast bands.
So I guess even like I don't know, I don't have any buildings that I can see or hear being constructed, being put up, but maybe even something farther away. They're probably not farther away, because that would just be, it wouldn't really be able to block the signal anymore from a, I don't know. Yeah, nothing obvious like that that I can see, like a building or something like that, but I guess a lot of other things like somebody's computer, maybe that stuff isn't affected like a strong broadcast FM signal way that affects ham bands. I don't know. So, yeah, okay, back to you.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to have that much problem with stray RF from electronic devices unless they're really off specs. Theoretically, if you had a guy who is transmitting, an amateur radio operator, a CB or such, it could get into your front end and diminish the sensitivity that way. But all things being equal, my guess would be that there's some construction. You know, it doesn't have to be next door. It could be a mile away if it's just right in line between you and an antenna. I mean, one of the ways to kind of figure out if that's what's going on, if it's having more an effect on some antennas than others, although very often FM broadcasters kind of cluster in relatively close quarters.
Yeah, it's just random, but usually the bedroom clock radio, it's a nice Bose clock radio, but it's just got that little thing, that wire antenna, and I'm sure it's not as good a receiver as my 7100, because it's 7100 is made for weaker ham bands and all that stuff. It's probably spec'd a lot higher, but sometimes one will be better than the other, and sometimes it's vice versa, so it's kind of funny.
Okay, that's strange. I would assume that most amateur radio have better front-end sensitivity rather than commercial products, because most radios aren't really sold for DXing type of things. They're basically built, designed, and sold for local radio broadcasts, and thankfully those signals are rather strong, so you don't need a very sensitive front end for a receiver. But it depends on a whole bunch of factors. Antenna placement is important as well. Whether what's behind the wall that you tacked on the little T antenna is important. All those things make or break a propagation.
With ham things, it's sometimes like I'll just have the normal vertical orientation. That's the best. But some stations, it's actually better horizontal because of the way signals are bouncing or what have you. But sometimes I have to change that. And one thing will work sometimes, another thing will work other times in certain situations. So at least with a mag mount, you can do that easily. You can try these different things. So I don't know, I guess that's probably all I have on this. Back to you. If I think of something better, I hope somebody else comes in with a good question. So back to you, Roy.
Okay, very well. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any questions or topics you would like to have discussed or make a comment of a technical nature, please feel free. Just hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. Well, it's going to be a real quiet night, I guess. Let me retread the topic that I kind of brought up Sunday night on the Limark Technical Net, in case some of you guys didn't listen to that. I came up with this interesting idea. I pulled out TechNets from all the way back in time. There's an archival site, amateurradio.tv, that has technical nets going back to 2006. So I was listening to 2006, and a gentleman was talking about how he had a power supply that was acting flaky. He would hit his transmitter on his radio, and all of a sudden the power supply would shut itself down and lock itself off, and he would have to reset his power supply, turn it off and turn it on again to get power going to his radio. And someone suggested that probably RF is getting into his power supply. So as is usually the case, the recommendation was ferrite clamps. Put a couple of ferrite clamps between the wires connecting the radio and the power supply, and it fixed the problem. So there was a discussion about how that works. And basically, it's a very, very simple concept. The power supply is feeding direct current. Impedance has no effect on direct currents. An inductor will let a direct current go right through it without any problem. The reactance or impedance of an inductor goes up as the frequency of the current goes up along with it. So when the power supply cord was being used, unfortunately, as an RF antenna and feeding back RF into the guy's power supply, that was causing all kinds of problems. Usually there are safety features in a power supply that limits the output. The as we mentioned in one of our puzzles about 3 months ago, it's not at all uncommon for power supplies to be able to output twice the voltage that we usually expect it. It's only when we run it through a voltage regulator that you get it down to the 13.6 volts or whatever that you want. Sometimes the voltage regulator will fail, and if it was allowed to fail, it could burn out your radio by supplying as much as 26 volts electricity. So there are safety circuits. Unfortunately, those safety circuits are confused by RF. So if RF gets into the safety circuits, it misreads it as a high voltage output, and it shuts down the power supply. So that if you put a high impedance by some ferrite clamps, you decrease the amount of RF current, and you limit that problem and solve that problem. Let me drop for a sec. I then brought up, to me, a somewhat more interesting problem. It's rather simple that you choke RF preferentially and you let the direct current through, but we often use ferrite chokes all the time on our transmission lines. In that case, RF is going up to our antenna, and we're trying to block RF going back down the coaxial cable and bathing our shack in RF. And the beauty of ferrite chokes is that they are able to block current reflected back in what's called common mode. Common mode meaning that the voltage potentials are the same, as opposed to the transmission of your power to your antenna, which is using differential mode, which is the inner aspect of the outer shielding and the outer surface of the center wire has opposing voltages and currents on them. So that's differential mode. Differential mode goes right past the RF chokes into the antenna, but if they reflect back into common mode, once they're common mode, the chokes will choke them. Not completely. You never get absolute impedance block, but just by adding an additional 100 or 200 ohms of inductive reactance, that's enough to block most of the RF current from going back into your shack. So that's why we use RF chokes. We use them as simple impedance blocks on power supplies or as common mode chokes in the case of antenna transmission lines. So hopefully if you missed that little presentation this Sunday, you caught it now. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any questions or comments, either about what I just said or anything else, please feel free. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Roy, yes, you have a question.
Yes, Glenn.
Yeah, Roy, I don't know if you remember, but I was having an RF issue on 10 meters on the net, and I bought a kit that... a commercial kit that basically gave me the ferrite chokes for just about every cable that connects to the radio. What I'm wondering is if when I use it on the feed line, am I losing any output, any signal by using one of those?
No, you are not, because, as I mentioned before, the transmission line from your transmitter to your antenna is going through what's called differential mode, which means that two nearby conductors have opposite voltages and currents. And as long as it's in differential mode, it's unaffected by the ferrite. The ferrite you can think of as a magnetic choke. And if it was one a current, it would cause a magnetic field. Because there's a positive and there's a negative current at the same time, they cancel out. There's no magnetic field. So there's no inductive reactance, no impedance to current flow. So as long as it's a differential mode transmission, which is what we all want to get up to the antenna, coaxial cables are designed for a differential mode. The interesting part to me is that antennas are actually designed for the exact opposite. Antennas have common mode currents. It's the current common mode current that allows them to radiate their signal out into space and propagate your RF signal. So you shouldn't have any loss whatsoever with your ferrite clamps. They should be invisible to differential mode coming out of your transmitter.
Also assume that having, assuming that there is one source of the RF, say in the radio, having the extra core, the extra ferrite cores has no impact on anything.
Yeah, it's only going to block common mode RF, and the only place you really should have common mode RF is on your antenna. You know, I wouldn't suggest anyone put ferrite clamps on antennas. But other than that, they are harmless. Sometimes you can pick the wrong mix. Different mixes are preferable for different bands, and they saturate at different points. Some are more amenable to higher power outputs than others. But all things being equal, they certainly can't give you any problems. Sometimes they're very helpful, as you found out with your microphone RF problem. Sometimes they're five layers of Band-Aid. Occasionally, people sort of use them as a ham radio version of aspirin. You know, no matter what ails you, you might as well just try it because they're inexpensive. But they're very, very useful many, many times, and I don't know of anyone who doesn't use ferrite clamps in some way in place on their shack configurations.
One other question, if I may. Do they have a service life? Do they have to be replaced?
As long as you treat them nicely, they'll go on forever. There's very little that ages by themselves, the ferrite. They're basically iron and a bunch of other metal oxides mixed together with a binding material. What can happen, though, is if you put too much common mode current through them, the energy has to go someplace. So they dissipate it as heat. And so either if you have a lot of common mode problems or if you have a very, very small ferrite that can, you know, doesn't have a lot of heat dissipation, you can burn out a ferrite. But for the most part, ferrites have a perpetual life as long as you don't expose them to environmental factors too harshly.
Thank you very much, and for the issue.
You're welcome, Glenn. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. And if you have a question or a topic or a comment of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
MVP, with a little question about what you were talking about, the power supply and the ferrites before.
Yeah, sure, Bob.
Probably not, but like you were saying, like, you know, RF could get generated in the, you know, the wire between the radio and the power supply, and I guess it would always, if it messes up the safety circuits in the radio, it's going to always say it's a higher voltage than it actually is. I'm just thinking, if it ever said it was a lower voltage, it probably wouldn't happen, because it's just probably adding voltage. That would be dangerous, because then, of course, you might get a fried radio because something else malfunctioned at the same time in the power supply, and it didn't warn, it didn't shut it down. So I'm guessing that's a no answer, but I just wanted to be sure.
Well, it's highly unlikely, because now you have to have two incredibly separate malfunctions simultaneously. I guess theoretically, depending upon how the safety circuit is designed, it could simply block it from functioning correctly. You know, rather than just reading as a low voltage, it could just kind of jam the hell out of some methods of safety circuits. But then you would also have to have a failure of the voltage regulator. Thankfully, that, at least from what people tell me, voltage regulation failures are not that terribly common. I think a lot more common is the power transistor failures rather than the regulators.
Okay, yeah. Well, I knew there would have to be, like you say, two malfunctions at the same time, which doesn't usually happen, though it could. But it's a rare thing. So, I just lost my train of thought. Oh, with the power transistor goes, that just makes it not work anymore, right? It doesn't do any damage to the radio, I assume.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way that most power supplies are designed these days is to fail themselves without bringing anything down along with them. So what you'll simply get is your power supply either will have low output or no output. And, it limits the problem to the power transistor. Sometimes you can have a cascade failure with power transistors, depending upon how they're designed, and the whole strip can blow out. But usually that's kind of the limit. It certainly doesn't cause any problems the way they're designed for the electronics that are plugged into the power output.
Very good. Yeah, I figured that. So, yeah, power supplies are generally considerably cheaper than the radios they're powering and the other equipment. Very good. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, power supplies are very interesting subjects in and of themselves. A lot of people swear by old-style linear power supplies. They have very big transformers in them, big and heavy and usually expensive. The last 30, 40 years, switching power supplies became very popular. But, you know, a lot of old-timers have war stories of a switching power supply that injected noise into his radio, and they have even pictures of it on their oscilloscopes and such. But for the most part, I've had switching power supplies. I haven't noticed any problem. I have one model of a power supply that's switching that can adjust the local oscillator of the switching circuit, so that even if you did feel that there was a noise coming out of it because of the frequency, you could adjust it and tweak it. I have not yet required doing that. So I'm a big fan of switching power supplies. They're relatively inexpensive. They're generally very well made. They're light, very efficient. So I'm a big fan of switching power supplies. But, you know, linear power supplies are great if you need weightlifting. If you need a good paperweight, they're sturdy devices.
Yeah, my power supply, which is the one you recommended to me a couple years ago, I believe has that adjustable, what do you call it, you know, the frequency or whatever it is. I can't find the terminology. It's the Elinco DM330MV, and it has that. I've never had any problem with this. Is it true that in the very beginning, when they first had switching power supplies, they were more likely to cause, you know, noise in the radio and stuff, but they've just improved the technology since then? That was my understanding. Back to you.
Yeah, I don't think they were inherently designed with a flaw. They were just not as bulletproof as they are today. And so one of the failure modes would be to have that switching noise injected into the radio to the consternation of old-timers who kind of never got over that. And to this very day, you go on the HF bands, you could almost always find some guy who just has no desire to deal with a switching power supply. You know, it's linear power supplies all the way. And if you ask them, usually if they're running a linear amplifier, those things that they're running very often are about 200 pounds. So they really believe in boat anchors.
I remember even Dick K2RIW one time when you were having some problems getting into the Limark net and you were trying to troubleshoot, and he even brought that up. Do you have a switching power supply? He didn't seem like real adamant about that, but he did bring it up. It was curious. So, yeah, back to you.
Yeah, that problem continued to confuse everyone, and the only thing that really solved it is, unfortunately, when Eric passed away, and they basically pulled out all the electronics and swapped it for a temporary one. I think it was a very weird interaction of Eric's voter system. It didn't like my signal, either because of my voice or my location. I don't know. Because at one point, I was so tired of people kind of saying, well, maybe it's your microphone. Well, maybe it's your antenna. Maybe it's your coax. Maybe it's your power supply. That I had two parallel systems next to each other that had nothing in common. I had one microphone fed to one radio by one power supply to one antenna and a completely separate one. And both of them were dropping out of Limark's repeater. So it was independent, at least, of the electronics. It, again, was either my location, because the two antennas were not that separated, or I am suspicious that it just didn't like some aspect or some subaudible aspect of my voice. It triggered some strangeness with their voting system. But who knows? Hopefully I won't find out, because hopefully when they wire up the voting system, they'll do it a little different this time and not put in an AC2GS filter.
AC2GS filters, not just kidding. Well, I mean, that's been fixed for a while now. I remember all that, what you were saying about your separate radios. I was listening to all those nets, or most of them, and I got a question for you. You said a voting system. I'm not even sure what, I don't even know what that is. So there's a question for you. Is it voting, like the same word as elections and stuff, or like vocoding or something like that? Back to you.
AC2GS. No, it's voting, like hopefully everyone will do November 3rd, unless they send out their ballot early. It's a voting system. It's an interesting additional aspect when you have repeaters that are linked by RF or internet or other aspects. You can have satellite receiver stations, and they'll pull signals and make judgment based upon the signal strength and the quality of the signal, and the repeater will select either its own signal received or the satellite signal received. So there were about two, three satellite receivers for Limark. One of them was, I think, on a roof of a hospital. There were a few others, and you need a voting system to be able to select the preferable received signal.
NBB, what are they? So they're receiving some of these ham sats or something? They're receiving signals from those, or what are they doing with these satellite signals?
No, they're not satellite. Well, they're not orbiting satellites. They're satellite receivers in the terms that they're secondary to the main receiver. So you have the main receiver on the repeaters, and then you have separate receiver stations that can't transmit the repeater signal. They can only receive it and then transmit a link signal to the main repeater. So the idea is, say, if the location where the hospital roof is getting a better signal from you than the repeater's main facility, it will switch over and transmit a link from there to the repeater so that it will improve the reception based upon your signal strength to the different satellite receiver stations built around the repeater area.
Yeah, I get it. I just didn't know that terminology, because since ham does use satellites sometimes, I was thinking that. Yeah, that makes sense. A little, like, so they have choices. They can, like, yeah, pick the best one at any given moment.
Yeah, it's not a standard thing. We don't have it, again, because we have basically one repeater and no other location. But they have, I think, I've lost track, at least six different repeaters. They have two FM analog UHF, yeah, let's see, two analog VHF, one UHF, at least one DMR, at least one fusion, and they probably have a D-Star someplace that's not connected. So they have a lot of systems, and they it costs them money. They rent out spaces and locations, and Eric was fiendish about it all. So he set up the voter system with all these other places that haven't been used in a couple of years. When he passed away, they kind of pulled the voter system out because Eric didn't bother to explain it to anyone else, and he didn't write much down. So they've had to reverse engineer the voter system. It hasn't gone back yet, so that's probably why I'm not falling out of their repeaters anymore.
So you were better off without any voting. But, yeah, it's like programmers who write terrible code and no one else can read the no comments or whatever. So that's interesting. So the fusion, they have a fusion. I guess it's probably a repeater that I can't reach from here with my HT. It's the only fusion radio I have. But I didn't know why Mark had a fusion repeater.
Yeah, I mean, they went in on the same deal that we did way back when Yaesu was just presenting the DR1X. We're now on the DR2X, but the DR1X, they had an incredible sweetheart deal. I think they were releasing it as a beta, and you could get a fully operational repeater for $300. I mean, in relation to anything else, that's like giving him away. So we took one, and Limark took at least one, and they hooked it up someplace. I've never heard a fusion transmission from them. I've assumed that it's hooked up someplace on Sussex County, so it's a little bit too far away and into Long Island for me to get. But they had that. They're very, very happy with their DMR station. That's active every day. I hear that. But the fusion, I haven't had an opportunity to hear.
I wonder if any of those are hooked through, like if I knew the right address, I could get it through my hotspot.
That's a good question. My guess would be that they did not swing for a WiresX attachment, so there's probably no WiresX room that's listed as Limark. I guess you could do a search for it, but I would be sort of surprised if that was what was going on. I think they just kind of got it as a inexpensive experiment, and Eric wasn't particularly thrilled, I guess, so it didn't go that far.
These fusion repeaters are like $300. What's a normal, for a repeater like that, normally we'd be paying, what, $1,000, $2,000, something like that?
Yeah, it depends if it's amateur or commercial, and if it's new or used. A commercial Motorola repeater, new, could set you back thousands of dollars. So, you know, $300, it was remarkable. I mean, I remember when I heard about it, and I told the guys that we can't turn this one down. It's just looking the gift horse in the mouth. So, a lot of repeaters were sold by Yaesu. They had hoped to kind of put the fusion digital technology front. They offered it as it's used today as a mixed medium, both analog and digital, but I think they would prefer people to use it on the digital side. But it was a deal that almost no club that I know of could turn down.
For Yeshua to comment.
Here, I guess that most clubs would be using that, whereas I guess consumer grade would be like you or me want our little repeater or something like that.
Well, I think we had to prove to them that we were a club, and in addition to getting the repeater, I think we got some sweatshirts or T-shirts or something. It was very nice. Glenn, you wanted to say something?
Just looking at the Limock website, their Grumman repeater is the Fusion mixed mode, 146745, it says, in plain view.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I think I tried to listen to it. I couldn't hear anything from it. So Plainview. Well, that makes sense. Plainview is a little bit far out for me.
Yeah, it looks like it just has an EchoLink node, an IRLP. It doesn't say anything about a fusion room or a way to connect that way through a hotspot.
Yeah, that would make sense to me. Again, I don't think Eric was that curious about the technology, so they probably just reused the facilities because they already have EchoLink and IRLP on their FM analog repeaters. So it's easier for them to just kind of duplicate what they already have than learn new tricks. So that's not surprising.
Yeah, I misspoke. The EchoLink is on their analog. It's not on the Grumman machine. My bad. Back to you.
Oh, well. I mean, for a time, unfortunately, their EchoLink was really in a guy's shack. He had taken the equipment and just hooked it up to a radio in his shack on the side, and every so often during the technical nets, I would have to kind of tap him on the shoulder and have him reboot it. I think they moved it back to the actual repeater facility about 2 or 3 months ago. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. It meets every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. If you have any questions of a technical nature, if you have any topics you want to discuss, if you have any technical comments to make, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, maybe it's time to play our little puzzle. So once again, it's not a convoluted, it's not a tricky one. It doesn't even require pretty pictures. The question is, if an AM signal is 100% modulated with a sine wave audio tone, the amplitude of each of the side bands is either A, half that of the carrier, B, equal to that of the carrier, C, twice that of the carrier, or D, four times that of the carrier.
Okay, 20B, if no one else wants to guess, I'll guess. I don't remember exactly what it is, but I could kind of hunch it.
Okay, very well, Bob. Hunch away.
I got to narrow down to two. It might either be half the carrier or equal to the carrier. I don't think, and I'm just sort of intuitively guessing without really knowing much. I know this is probably even on the exams, probably tech in general. I might say, I'll guess B equal. I don't think it could be any greater than the carrier, and maybe it could only be half. Anyway, I'll say equal. If it's not equal, my second choice is half. So B or A.
Okay, very good. Anyone else want to vote? I guess not. Well, it's almost right, because if you consider the amplitude of both of the side bands in relation to the carrier, then you would be right with the first answer you gave. It's the equal amplitude of both of the side bands together. versus the carrier. So it's 50-50 for that. But since the question was each of the sidebands, both of the sidebands hold 50% of the power, so each of them holds about one quarter of the power. If the carrier has half the power and one sideband has a quarter of the power, then the answer is A, half that of the carrier.
That makes sense. I'm just trying to visualize this. You got to distort the wave and half, yeah, you're right, because half the wave sort of sticking above the zero line, and I guess you couldn't really push it up higher than that. So, yeah, half makes just sort of visual sense to me. Heck.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of people don't really think in terms of, they think of amplitude modulation as that lovely picture where there's a fast sine wave, and superimposed on the very fast sine wave, which is the carrier, I guess, is a audio sound wave that's much lower in frequency, that's modulating the amplitude of that carrier signal. So the simplest way of looking at it is the radio just sort of receives the carrier signal, and that's AM. It's a little bit more esoteric. It requires the use of a nonlinear device like a diode. Nonlinear devices act as mixers. So what happens is if you feed an amplitude-modulated RF signal in through a mixer, it will mix together the carrier and the sidebands, and you'll get the upper sideband difference and the lower sideband difference as the audio signal that goes out to the demodulator and the audio amplifier. So, in fact, all amplitude modulation signals are not that pretty, just that pretty picture of a modulated carrier wave, but a carrier wave in the middle and two sidebands on either side. So it's that more complex, realistic view of amplitude modulation that some people don't kind of think about when you say the word amplitude modulation to them.
I fell into that category too because I was sort of thinking how the waves just get made bigger than, you know, than it was for a while and that it couldn't go any more than doubling from each side. Yeah, so I fell into that trap as well.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's how we learn things. If I pick questions that I think 101% everyone has already kind of heard that a few dozen times, it's no fun. So all these questions, you know, there's always that chance of not quite remembering it right. Next time we'll be doing a question about propagation conditions and such, which is always an interesting topic. So once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We've been doing this for about 50 minutes, so we're probably going to call it a night unless someone has any questions or topics. If anyone has anything out there, please let me know. We'll keep going. Otherwise, we'll call it a night.
NVB, just with a quick sort of comment or question. I don't need something in depth.
Okay, very good, Bob.
Yeah, actually, before the pandemic, I started reading a book on my Kindle, an ARRL book called Antenna Physics. I think I'd actually brought that up to you before, 6 months ago or something. But it's kind of interesting, and I just started looking at it again. I just fell in other things. I hadn't been looking at it in months. I'm reviewing some of what I already read. But it's like, you know, basic explanations for someone like me, you know, which is makes it understandable, showing the sphere of the propagation and how you just take a section of that, and that's how you get the what they call the aperture, and that's just like your received signal compared to the transmit signal. And anyway, I don't know if you ever heard of that book. It's sort of one of those in-between books from completely beginner and completely, you know, you'd be reading the one just out of the handbook. So it's sort of in between that.
Yeah, I heard of it. The problem is I have so many darn books these days that I don't know if that's part of my library. My guess would be that it is somewhere down there. I kind of grab any antenna book that looks interesting that's more than a couple of hundred pages, because unfortunately the ARRL kind of sells a lot of glorified pamphlets, and you know, they're reprints from the magazine of different designs. I mean, they're interesting, but I find them a wee bit overpriced. There's this great antenna book called Rothamel. It's actually a German book. It's primarily for German hams, but for whatever reason this year they actually did an English translation. So I think it's the 15th edition in German, but I have the first edition in English. And, you know, they're all interesting. I mean, I would suggest that unless you are invulnerable to bloody noses, you should never read an antenna textbook from an electrical engineering course, because the mathematics will just drive you insane.
That's a little too much Greek for me at this stage. Yeah, this book throws some of that at you, and he does well. You work, you know, and it's actually challenging for me. I don't think I'd want to, like you say, I know I wouldn't read one of these ones at KTRW, or even you would just grab and read, because, you know, I'm not on that level. If I ever want to get to that level, I'd have to maybe read a book like this, and, well, I'll get what I get out of it, you know. I can get something out of this book. This book's even hard for me a lot of the time. I have to kind of read things two or three times and think about it. So, yeah, I think it's good for me if I bear with it. Back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're doing it for and what you plan to get out of it and how much you're willing to take for the team. I never bought a college textbook on antenna theory. I downloaded a PDF version from someplace on the internet just out of curiosity. And the matrix math and such, which thankfully you pretty much never see in the ARRL handbook, antenna handbook, or Rothamel even doesn't have it. If you pick up an electrical engineering textbook, they apparently have no way to limit themselves. They have to give you the matrix math of what's going on with the currents and the voltage potentials and in 3D space. It's not fun.
I mean, to me, the handbook is even very technical, so I wouldn't go beyond that. So I'm thinking of buying a new handbook just because the nice way they package them in like six little slim volumes, so you don't have to pick up a 10-pound book and hurt your wrists every time you try to read it. But other than that, it's probably not that different. So. Yeah, I shouldn't take all night about this. I just wanted to bring that up, and I'm going to, like, try to get back into this book. My problem is I have too many interests. I go off in too many directions. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I have the same problem. I kind of gave up at this point, but I was trying to really be able to understand Morse code. I can send Morse code, but my speed just is awful. And the problem with that is if you don't use it, you lose it. So what would happen is I'd get really into it for about 2 weeks, and then I'd get distracted by something else and come back to it a month later, and it was all gone. And it was like that mountain in the old fable of Sisyphus, of rolling a enormous boulder up a mountainside and only having it fall down to the bottom every night and getting up in the morning and rolling it back up, never quite getting to the top of the mountain. So right now I've kind of given up on Morse code, unfortunately. Maybe one of these days I'll try it once again.
I like that with Morse code too. I mean, Morse code is like learning a musical instrument. It's the kind of thing, it's not just knowledge, it's motor skill, it's you know, it's that kind of thing. You know what I mean. So it's practice, and it's like getting stuff like in your body that's just I guess neural pathways or what have you, and you just kind of have to like you know, once you get something like an instrument, you can lay off a little while, and then, you know, you can just dust it off when you come back. But when you're learning it, you really got to, like, kind of be some kind of consistency. Like they say, as we know, it's better to do 15 minutes a day than to do 2 hours and then do 2 hours again 10 days later. And So, yeah, I hear you. So, anyway, I should be going myself. Like I told you, like, I'm getting up early tomorrow for one of my other little interests, birding in Prospect Park. So this is very interesting, Net, and I'm going to try to read some of this stuff. So I'll know enough to ask some good questions. Back to you, Roy. Great, Net.
Well, thank you, and thank you for participating, and thank you for being co-host. And yeah, read through it, and if you find something interesting that you'd like to share or a topic that you'd like me to talk about in some way, feel free. So thanks a lot, Bob. Once again, this is AC2GS, Roy, with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any further questions or topics tonight, let me know. Otherwise, we'll call it a night. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be November 4th, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Our regular general meeting begins at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also have a weekly net featuring Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on our club website. On our club repeater, rather. If you communicate using Fusion Digital Technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using a Fusion Digital Technology radio or by using a hotspot in some other digital technology mode using our network gateways, such as our XLX server. We also offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater. That's located with the URL stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are always welcome to participate on all of our nets, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is available on our club website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk a little bit less. So we'll roll this up and shut it down now, but we'll be back to do this all over again October 28th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. And thanks to our club president, Joseph, AC2AE, who set up a wonderful crossband so that I could get out to the repeater under the circumstances of my iffy antenna system. Anyway, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting out of here. Have a safe week, guys. Be well, and take care of yourselves.
Roy, great net, NVB, clear.